And welcome back to Weird on the Rocks. This is a podcast that explores the weird, unusual, strange, and unexplained, all while getting our drink on. I'm your host, Katie. Before we get into it today, I want to first say that I hope everyone is staying safe and healthy right now. I live in California, and just today we instituted a shelter in place due to the COVID-19 virus, and I'm sure a lot of you guys are in the same boat right now. It's a really scary and uncertain time right now for all of us. And I just hope that all of you guys are doing okay out there. Please take this seriously and do your part by staying home as much as possible and practicing social distancing, washing your hands a lot, all that stuff. If we all just do as we're told, hopefully this thing can be, you know, eradicated in a few weeks rather than a few months, best case scenario. But we all have to do our part and take it seriously. I think at a time like this, when people are stuck inside, that podcasts and movies and stuff are a really great resource to have. So I'm glad that I can be recording this today, and hopefully you guys can still enjoy it even though life is really stressful and hectic right now. And maybe hanging out with me and listening to my voice will make you feel a little less alone. I'm going to be the crazy lady talking in your house with you. So today's episode is kind of a fun one and probably something most of you haven't heard about, and that is the story of The Watcher. This is a story I first heard about on the YouTube channel BuzzFeed Unsolved, which is a channel where they discuss true crime, conspiracies, paranormal stuff, pretty much the same stuff as my podcast, but it's two guys that host it and they're hilarious. So definitely check out BuzzFeed Unsolved. I never heard of this story, but it instantly sparked my interest, and I put it down on my podcast topic list immediately after watching the video. This story is definitely weird and creepy, and it's never been solved, which of course makes it even creepier. I used several different articles for this episode, but the main one that I got my information from was an article in the New York Magazine, which did a super in-depth investigation into this story. So hopefully if you're familiar with this story, you can still enjoy my take on it. And if you haven't heard of it, I think you're really going to enjoy it. If you'd like to find the show, I'm on Facebook and Instagram at Weird on the Rocks Podcast, the website weirdontherocks.weebly.com, and Twitter at weird_rocks. Please rate and review on iTunes and push the subscribe button wherever you're listening now so that you'll always have the newest episode. Before we get into the good stuff, I want to share this week's beverage of choice. Tonight I'm drinking a French 75, which frankly I'm pissed that I did not know about until now. I've seen it on drink menus before, and for some reason I thought it had whiskey or bourbon or something in it that I don't like, but it doesn't. It literally has my two favorite things, which are gin and champagne. It also has lemon juice and simple syrup, and it is so delicious. I should have been drinking these my entire life. I'm really happy that I finally discovered these. So yeah, it's great. You guys should definitely try one of these if you like gin, which I know most people don't, but my fellow gin lovers, this is a great cocktail. All right, well, cheers and let's get weird. In June of 2014, Derek and Maria Broaddus, along with their three children, ages 5, 8, and 10, began moving into their new home in Westfield, New Jersey, a town of about 30,000 and about 45 minutes from New York. In 2014, a nationwide survey ranked Westfield as the 30th safest town in America. And in 2018, Bloomberg ranked it as the 99th highest income town in America. Westfield is 80% white, and in 2018, when surveyed, the residents of the town said the most concerning issue was the Trader Joe's temporarily shutting down because their roof had collapsed. The Broaddus' new home, 657 Boulevard, was built in 1905 and was a beautiful six-bedroom, four-bath colonial-style home in a wealthy neighborhood that Derek and Maria were extremely excited about, especially since they had a bidding war over the home and ended up purchasing it for well over the asking price. Maria had grown up just down the street and had always loved the home and its traditional architecture. Derek had grown up in Maine, but landed a job in Manhattan at an insurance company. Over the years, he had worked his way up to senior vice president, giving him a salary large enough to buy the $1.3 million house. The website Zillow describes the home as, quote, period features include high ceilings, elegant foyers, built-in window seats, fireplaces, and more. The stunning master suite boasts a custom dressing room, closet, and a renovated bath, two porches, a covered open front porch, and an enclosed side sun porch with stone fireplace add to the inviting appeal. An open staircase leads to the third floor with sitting area, two bedrooms, and renovated bath with skylight. A finished playroom is located in the basement. End quote. The family of five quickly started unpacking and began doing some minor renovations to make the home a bit more modern before they decided to officially move in. 3 days after closing on the home, Derek was alone at the house and had spent the night painting while the rest of the family was sleeping at their old house. Around 10 p.m., Derek decided to check the mail and see if any mail had been forwarded to their new address yet. There were several items in the mailbox, all bills, except for the last item. It was a small white envelope with the words, "The New Owner," written on the front in big, thick letters. There was a stamp, but no return address. Derek assumed it was from someone in the neighborhood, so he opened it and found a typed note that read, quote, "Dearest new neighbor at 657 Boulevard, allow me to welcome you to the neighborhood. 657 Boulevard has been the subject of my family for decades now, and as it approaches its 110th birthday, I have been put in charge of watching and waiting for its second coming. My grandfather watched the house in the 1920s, and my father watched it in the 1960s. It is now my time. Do you know the history of the house? Do you know what lies within the walls of 657 Boulevard? Why are you here? I will find out." End quote. The letter then went on to mention the make and model of their minivan and said, quote, "I see already that you have flooded 657 Boulevard with contractors so that you can destroy the house as it was supposed to be. Tsk, tsk, tsk. Bad move. You don't want to make 657 Boulevard unhappy. You have children. I have seen them. So far, I think there are three that I have counted. Are there more on the way? Do you need to fill the house with the young blood I requested? Better for me. Was your old house too small for the growing family? Or is it greed to bring me to your children? Once I know their names, I will call to them and draw them to me. Who am I? There are hundreds and hundreds of cars that drive by 657 Boulevard every day. Maybe I am in one. Look at all the windows you can see from 657 Boulevard. Maybe I am in one. Look out any of the many windows in 657 Boulevard at all the people who stroll by each day. Maybe I am one. Welcome, my friends. Welcome. Let the party begin." End quote. It was signed, "The Watcher." Derek immediately ran around the home, turning off all the lights to make sure nobody could see inside, and then he called the Westfield police. An officer arrived and read the letter, to which he responded, quote, "What the fuck is this?" End quote. The officer asked Derek if he or Maria had any enemies that would send such a letter, to which Derek said no. The officer also suggested that Derek move some construction equipment from the front yard into the backyard in case this person tried to throw it through the front window. The officer told Derek to contact them if another letter arrived, and Derek went back to his old home where his family was staying. Once he arrived there, he and Maria wrote an email to John and Andrea Woods, the previous homeowners who had owned the house for 23 years, asking if they had ever received anything similar. Andrea Woods replied the next day and said that a few days before moving out, they had also received a letter from the Watcher. The letter mentioned that the Watcher had also been observing the Woods family over the years. Andrea said that she thought the letter was odd, but threw it away and tried not to overreact. Maria informed the Westfield police that the previous homeowners had received a similar letter, and the police told her to not tell anyone about the letters, especially any neighbors, because they were all now suspects. In the following weeks, Maria and Derek paid extreme attention to everything around them. They didn't allow their children outside alone, and Derek canceled a work trip so that he didn't have to leave his family. One morning, a contractor working on the house noticed that a sign that he had hung up the night before had been ripped out of the wall. 2 weeks after the first letter arrived, Maria found another white envelope in their mailbox with thick black writing on it. This time, it was addressed to M/M Broaddus, with their last name misspelled. The letter read, quote, "Welcome again to your new home at 657 Boulevard. The workers have been busy, and I have been watching you unload carfuls of your personal belongings. The dumpster is a nice touch. Have they found out what is in the walls yet? In time, they will." End quote. The letter also mentioned all three of the Broaddus children by birth order and their nicknames, saying, quote, "I am pleased to know your names now and the name of the young blood you have brought to me. You certainly say their names often." End quote. This scared Maria, as she had recently visited a neighbor and allowed her children to run around the yard before calling them in. The letter continued to say, quote, "657 Boulevard is anxious for you to move in. It has been years and years since the young blood ruled the hallways of the house. Have you found all the secrets it holds yet? Will the young blood play in the basement? Or are they too afraid to go down there alone? I would be very afraid if I were them. It is far away from the rest of the house. If you were upstairs, you would never hear them scream. Will they sleep in the attic? Or will you all sleep on the second floor? Who has the bedrooms facing the street? I'll know as soon as you move in. It will help me to know who is in which bedroom. Then I can plan better. All of the windows and doors in 657 Boulevard allow me to watch you and track you as you move through the house. Who am I? I am the Watcher and have been in control of 657 Boulevard for the better part of 2 decades now. The Woods family turned it over to you. It was their time to move on and kindly sold it when I asked them to. I pass by many times a day. 657 Boulevard is my job, my life, my obsession. And now you are too, Broaddus family. Welcome to the product of your greed. Greed is what brought the past 3 families to 657 Boulevard, and now it has brought you to me. Have a happy moving in day. You know I will be watching." End quote. After receiving this letter, Derek and Maria decided to stop bringing their children to the new home. A few weeks later, they received a third letter, which said, quote, "Where have you gone to? 657 Boulevard misses you. The house is crying from all the pain it is going through. You have changed it and made it so fancy. You are stealing its history. It cries for the past and what used to be in the time when I roamed its halls. The 1960s were a good time for 657 Boulevard when I ran from room to room imagining the life with the rich occupants there. The house was full of life and young blood. Then it got old, and so did my father. But he kept watching until the day he died, and now I watch and wait for the day when the young blood will be mine again." End quote. Although Derek and Maria had already been racking their brains for who could be writing these letters, they began to think about it even more. They realized that the first letter had arrived before the sale was even public, and the previous owners, the Woods, had never even put up a for sale sign. The police were also able to track the letters to Kearney, New Jersey, where there was a postal service distribution center, meaning that the letter was from New Jersey. They realized that the author of these letters was in very close proximity to them, close enough to hear Maria say the children's names and see them bringing their belongings into the house. Maria began to think that perhaps the Watcher was someone who had wanted to buy the house but had been outbid by them. She emailed Andrea Woods again to ask if there were any prospective buyers who seemed hostile about not getting the home. Andrea explained that although there were originally 2 other interested buyers whom the Broadduses had a bidding war with, one buyer backed out due to health issues and the other backed out because they ended up buying another house. She didn't believe that either had any resentment towards Derek and Maria for purchasing the home. Andrea instead suggested that perhaps it was a neighbor because they had mentioned knowing the children's names and were aware that they had contractors working in the home. Around this time, Derek and Maria attended a barbecue at a neighbor's home and saw this as the perfect time to scope out their new neighbors and see if anything or anyone fell off. Well, at the barbecue, Derek began talking to a man named John Schmidt, who lived two doors down. John began to tell Derek about the Langfords, who lived in the home between them and had been there since the 1960s. Peggy Langford was in her 90s, and several of her adult children in their 60s lived with her. Her husband had passed some years ago. John told him that one of the younger siblings, Michael Langford, was a bit odd and didn't work. Derek thought that this must be the author of the letters. The watcher had mentioned that their father had also watched over the home in the 60s, so this would make perfect sense. Derek contacted Detective Lugo, who had been assigned to their case, and told him his suspicions about Michael Langford. Lugo admitted that he had actually already interviewed Michael Langford, based mostly on the fact that he lived so close to the Broaddus's. However, he said that Michael claimed to know nothing about the letters. Detective Lugo admitted that Michael was odd and seemed very well-read and intelligent and could see him being the author of the letters, but without a confession, there wasn't much that he could do. In an interview with journalist Reeves Wiedemann from New York Magazine, Derek said, quote, "This is someone who threatened my kids, and the police are saying, probably nothing's going to happen, probably isn't good enough for me. This person attacked my family, and where I'm from, if you do that, you get your ass beat," end quote. With the police being of no help, Derek began to take matters into his own hands. He installed cameras all over the property and spent his nights crouched down in the dark living room staring out the windows, hoping to catch somebody staring back. He also created a map that showed all the homes surrounding 657 Boulevard and when those families had moved in, as well as what homes would be in earshot to hear Maria yelling the children's names. Derek also decided to hire a private investigator, former FBI agent Robert Lenihan. Lenihan conducted a background check on all members of the Langford family, but found nothing. He also analyzed the letters and concluded that they were written by someone older. The second letter was addressed to M/M Broaddus, which is a more old-fashioned way of writing Mr. and Mrs., and it also included double spaces between each sentence. Lenihan also concluded that due to how well-written the letters were, that the author was most likely a, quote, "voracious reader," end quote, and that the lack of profanity for how supposedly angry this person was also pointed to an older individual. Although Lenihan believed that the watcher wasn't going to act on their threats, he did sense a sort of erraticism from the letters, such as typos and the fact that the first letter was dated Tuesday, June 4th, when June 4th was a Wednesday. He also sensed that the author had a deep hatred for the wealthy, and especially new money. He thought perhaps the watcher was jealous of the fact that the Broadduses could afford the house and they couldn't, and implored them to look into former housekeepers or staff. However, Derek still felt as though the Langfords had something to do with this. In an attempt to cause a reaction, he sent a letter to them explaining that they intended to tear down 657 Boulevard to build two homes on the lot instead, one for them to live in and one for them to rent out. However, this garnered no response from the Langfords. Detective Lugo brought Michael Langford in for a second interview, hoping to get some more information from him, but Michael continued to deny any involvement. Soon after, Abby Langford, Michael's sister, accused the Westfield police of harassing him and the family. Derek then decided to seek legal counsel and hired lawyer Lee Levitt. Derek, Maria, Lee, and the Langford family, along with their attorney, decided to have a meeting regarding the matter. In this meeting, the Broadduses showed the Langfords the letters, which they had not yet seen for themselves. Derek also showed them the map that he had created, which showed the homes that were close to theirs, and brought up the fact that the Langfords had been on the street the longest. Eventually, the meeting grew tense, with Derek and Maria becoming emotional and the Langfords becoming defensive. After this meeting, Maria began having bad dreams and high levels of anxiety. She was barely sleeping and soon sought out a therapist to help her cope with the fear that she was experiencing. Detective Lugo, realizing that Michael Langford wasn't going to budge, decided to look into other individuals in the neighborhood. He discovered that two child sex offenders lived in the neighborhood and interviewed both, but found nothing out of the ordinary. The Broaddus' house painter, Bill Woodard, also noticed that an older couple who lived behind them had their lawn chairs extremely close to the fence. He said, quote, "One day I was looking out the window and I saw this older guy sitting in one of the chairs. He wasn't facing his house, he was facing the Broaddus's," end quote. Detective Lugo also spoke to this couple but found nothing odd. By the end of 2014, the investigation into who the watcher was had come to a standstill. There was no digital trail to follow since the letters had been typed on a typewriter and no fingerprints were found on any of the letters. In December of 2014, the Westfield police told Derek and Maria that there wasn't anything else they could do. Scott Krause from the Union County Prosecutor's Office said, quote, "It was like trying to find a needle in a haystack," end quote. At this point, Derek decided to show the letters to a priest and had him come and bless the home. Finally, the renovations on 657 Boulevard were completed, but Derek and Maria were now faced with the question, did they actually want to move into the home? Would they continue to get letters? Would their children feel safe there? Maria told journalist Reeves Wiedemann, quote, "At the end of the day, it came down to, what are you willing to risk? We weren't going to put our kids in harm's way," end quote. Then another letter arrived. This one said, quote, 657 Boulevard is turning on me. It is coming after me. I don't understand why. What spell did you cast on it? It used to be my friend, and now it is my enemy. I am in charge of 657 Boulevard. It is not in charge of me. I will fend off its bad things and wait for it to become good again. It will not punish me. I will rise again. I will be patient and wait for this to pass and for you to bring the young blood back to me. 657 Boulevard needs young blood. It needs you. Come back. Let the young blood play again like I once did. Let the young blood sleep in 657 Boulevard. Stop changing it and leave it alone," end quote. Maria and Derek decided to sell their old home, which they were still staying at, and move in with her parents. They told only a few close friends about the letters, and so when people would ask why they hadn't moved into 657 yet, they would say that they were having legal issues. This spurred rumors in the small town that they were getting a divorce. And in fact, all of the stress they were feeling did start to wear on their marriage. They were both taking sleeping medication to fall asleep at night, and Maria upped her therapist visits. In one meeting, her therapist asked Maria how she was, causing Maria to burst into tears. Her therapist said that Maria was suffering from post-traumatic stress that would only go away if they sold the house. So they made the hard decision to sell their dream home only 6 months after closing on it and having never moved in. They listed it for more than they paid to reflect the renovations they had done, but rumors about the home began swirling in the small suburban town. Several real estate agents said they had interested buyers, but they wanted to know why the Broaddus's were selling it before they put in an offer. Derek and Maria decided to send a partial disclosure to any interested buyers, briefly explaining the letters and that a full disclosure would be provided if an offer was accepted. Soon, several bids came in, but they were far below the asking price, and Derek and Maria didn't want to lose the money they had put into the home. They lowered the price a bit, but still, nobody was willing to pay it because of the disclosed information about the letters from the watcher. The Broaddus's real estate agent, Coldwell Banker, said that they were providing too much information to potential buyers, and an email from them said, quote, "My friend got horrible threatening letters about her dog barking, and she didn't think to disclose it," end quote. To which Derek replied, quote, "I don't know how you lived through what we did and think that you could do it to somebody else," end quote. Derek and Maria began to think about whether or not they would have moved into 657 Boulevard if the previous owners, the Woods, would have disclosed to them the fact that they had received a letter. They concluded that they would not have purchased the home, so they decided to file a legal complaint against the Woods for not disclosing the information upon their offer being accepted, just like they were trying to do for the next owners. Soon, the media got wind of the story, and Derek and Maria were bombarded with media requests. They had still not explained to their children what was happening, so in order to get away from the questions, they went to stay with a friend at their beach house. Here, the Broaddus's finally sat down with their children to explain why they weren't moving into 657 Boulevard. And of course, their children had tons of questions. When asked about this talk, Derek said, quote, "Can you imagine having that conversation with a five-year-old? Your town isn't as safe as you think it is, and there's a boogeyman obsessed with you?" End quote. With the media now aware of the story, the public began coming up with their own theories on who the Watcher could be. Someone left a comment on a newspaper article saying that the Broaddus's should use ground-penetrating radar to find out what the Watcher claims was in the walls. However, their home inspector said the walls had been previously looked at, and the only issue found was the fact that the home had poor insulation. A Reddit forum dedicated to the story speculated who the Watcher could be, and their theories ranged from it being a jilted mistress, a realtor who missed out on selling the home, a local high school student's writing assignment, and guerrilla marketing for a new horror film. Many ridiculed the Broaddus's for not moving in and said that they were overreacting, and that not moving in was giving the Watcher exactly what they wanted. Once the story went public, the small town of Westfield was shocked, and many were afraid to be out and about. Lori Clancy, who lived behind 657 Boulevard and taught piano lessons, said one of her students who had a lesson showed up crying because she was terrified to walk down the boulevard. The letters were even brought up at the next Westfield City Council meeting, where the mayor assured the public that the Watcher hadn't been heard from in a year, and that although nobody was ever charged with the crime, the police had done an exhaustive investigation. Neighbors of 657 Boulevard were surprised to hear this, because none of them, except for the couple behind them and the Langfords, had ever spoken to the police about the letters. Several of them got together and wrote a letter that they sent to the local newspaper, which said, quote, "We are confounded as to how a thorough investigation can be concluded without talking to all the neighbors within proximity to the home," end quote. Upon reading this letter from the neighbors, Westfield detective Baron Chambliss decided to re-examine the case, telling journalist Reeves Wiedemann, quote, "The Broaddus's are victims, and I don't think they got the support they needed," end quote. Detective Chambliss decided to once again speak to the Langford family. In this meeting, Sandy Langford, the brother to suspect Michael Langford, confessed that Michael had been diagnosed with schizophrenia as a young man, a detail that had not been revealed yet. Sandy told Detective Chambliss that Michael was known to spook newcomers to the neighborhood by walking through their yard or peeking into their homes that were being renovated. However, Sandy said that Michael's behavior was harmless and, albeit odd, was never dangerous or threatening. Detective Chambliss talked to other neighbors, including John Schmidt, who had originally told Derek Broaddus about the Langfords, and they all said that he was a kind man who wasn't capable of writing such menacing letters to an innocent family. While Chambliss dug deeper into the investigation and analyzed the original documents, he found something alarming. The Westfield police had conducted a DNA analysis from one of the Watcher letter envelopes, and it was determined to be DNA from a female. Chambliss decided to look further into Abby Langford, Michael Langford's sister, who was a realtor. Perhaps she was angry that the Woodses didn't use her as their real estate agent. Abby also worked at a local department store, and Chambliss was able to get one of Abby's plastic water bottles from a store security guard. However, the DNA was not a match. Detective Chambliss also got Andrea Woods, the previous homeowner, to submit a DNA sample, which was also not a match. Maria Broaddus also gave a DNA sample, which was not a match, ruling her out as a potential suspect as well. Soon after, the prosecutor's office told Derek and Maria that the Langfords were officially ruled out as suspects. The Broaddus's were stunned, as they had recently told the prosecutor's office that they planned on filing civil charges against the Langfords, and thought perhaps the prosecutor's office was just trying to save themselves from a legal hassle in the public eye. Once again, Derek and Maria decided to take things into their own hands. They walked around the neighborhood with a copy of one of the Watcher's envelopes, asking if anyone recognized the handwriting. They also hired Robert Leonard, a renowned forensic linguist, to cross-examine the Watcher's language with anything online. This produced nothing, other than Leonard believing that the Watcher might be a fan of the show Game of Thrones, because the character Jon Snow has the title of Watcher on the Wall. One night, Detective Chambliss and his partner were sitting in the back of a van looking at the home through binoculars when a car drove up and stopped right in front of 657 Boulevard. They traced the plates to a young woman whose boyfriend lived on the boulevard. When asked by the police, she said something about her boyfriend playing very dark and violent video games, including one in which he played a character named The Watcher. Chambliss called her boyfriend, who agreed on two separate occasions to meet with the detective, but failed to show up both times. Chambliss decided to let it go, as he didn't have any real evidence to entice the man to meet with him. The media tension surrounding the story eventually began to die down, and the story of The Watcher became a sort of local urban legend. People began speculating that if the police couldn't find anyone responsible for the letters, perhaps they only needed to look right in front of them at the Broaddus's themselves. Many believe that Derek and Maria had gone in over their heads financially with the home and its renovations and concocted some sinister plan to get out of the deal. Others thought that perhaps they were planning some sort of insurance fraud, and several people in the community pointed out the fact that the Broaddus's had started in a $315,000 home, then upgraded to a $1.3 million home. Derek responded to this observation that, quote, "It's America," end quote, and explained that he had moved up the corporate ladder and was simply making more money. One community member even wrote into a local paper saying that the entire thing was a scam and that, quote, "an elaborate scheme is underway to defraud the Woods family for millions of dollars," end quote. Maria, who had grown up in the neighborhood and had family in the area, was upset that her neighbors thought she and her husband might be con artists. And Derek believed that people were so naive that they would rather accuse people of being scam artists than consider something bad happening in their small town. He said, quote, "There's a natural tendency to say, I've lived here for 35 years. Nothing's happened to me. What happened to my family is an affront to their contention that they're safe, and there's no such thing as mental illness in their community. People don't want to believe that this could happen in Westfield," end quote. In fact, some people in the town began to worry that Westfield would now have a negative association surrounding it. City Council member Mark Lagrippo said, quote, "People were worried about their property value and the stigma of the neighborhood," end quote. Derek and Maria felt like they didn't belong in their small town anymore and felt judged by their community members. Derek wanted to move out of the area, but Maria didn't want to leave where she had grown up and didn't want to uproot her children. Maria said, quote, "This person took so much from us. I wouldn't let them take more," end quote. It had now been 2 years since the first Watcher letter arrived, and Derek and Maria borrowed money from family to purchase a new home in Westfield, but were still paying the mortgage on 657 Boulevard too. In 2016, they put 657 Boulevard back on the market, hoping that with how many people said they would have ignored the letters and moved in anyway, they would have some interested buyers. They held an open house, which was well received, and then afterwards compared the signatures of everyone who had signed in with the writing from The Watcher, but there were no matches. They had several interested parties, but all of them backed out after meeting with the Broaddus's lawyers and being shown the letters. The Broaddus's lawyer then suggested a new plan: sell the lot to developers who would tear the house down and build two homes in the area, and believed that they could get $1 million for the lot. But in order for this to happen, the Westfield Planning Board would have to grant an exception because the two lots would each be 67 feet wide, 3 feet shy of the 70-foot law. The planning board meeting was public and over 100 people were in attendance. One of the attendees was a woman who lived across the street from 657 Boulevard and brought her lawyer along to fight the proposal. It was also mentioned that Wells Fargo showed interest in the lot for a new branch, but it was quickly shot down as someone mentioned that Wells Fargo branches always use lights that are too bright for their small town. Some were also concerned that the development would require trees to be cut down and that the new units would have to have street-facing garages, which was aesthetically unpleasing. Many residents of the boulevard spoke up to say that this new development would ruin their beautiful street, and Abby Langford, a previous suspect, stood up and said, quote, "I've spent almost 60 years looking at a magnificent, beautiful home, and I don't want to look out at a driveway," End quote. During the fourth hour of the meeting, neighbor Tom Higgins was the first to bring up the reason why any of them were even there, the letters from the watcher. He said, quote, "Has anybody thought about whether or not this lunatic who did this has been apprehended?" End quote. And he went on to say that with the watcher still out there, it was inevitable that the new owners of these two proposed homes would just face the same problems. While several people spoke up to defend the Broaddus's and urged others to show some compassion for what they were going through, the majority claimed that this was all for financial profit and that they had this plan from the very beginning. However, the Broaddus's explained that selling the lot would only help stop their financial bleeding, not give them any monetary benefit. They were still paying two mortgages, had renovations completed, and had almost paid $100,000 in property taxes for the home. Finally, at almost midnight, after a five-hour meeting, the planning board unanimously rejected the proposal. Derek and Maria were stunned. They told the board that they knew 657 Boulevard was a beautiful and treasured home, but they were hoping that they would see past that and help them in their dire time of need. Maria said, quote, "This is my town. I grew up here. I came back. I chose to raise my kids here. You know what we've been through. You had the ability, 2.5 years into a nightmare, to make it a little better, and you've decided that this house is more important than we are." End quote. Father Saporito, the priest who had blessed their home, was also in attendance and remarked on how many people expressed to him that they believed the entire thing was a scam. He said, quote, "I think the human element of this story was kind of lost on the neighbors," end quote. A few weeks after the planning board shot down their proposal, Derek and Maria were ecstatic to learn that a family wanted to rent 657 Boulevard from them. The renter wasn't worried about the letters, but did ask for a clause in their lease that would allow them to leave if the letters returned. A few weeks after they moved in, Derek went to the house to deal with some squirrels that had started chewing on the roof, and the renter handed him a white envelope. In it was a typed letter that on the front said, quote, "Violent winds and bitter cold to the vile and spiteful Derek and his wench of a wife, Maria," end quote. Inside, the letter said, quote, "You wonder who the watcher is? Turn around, idiots. Maybe you even spoke to me, one of the so-called neighbors who has no idea who the watcher could be. Or maybe you do not know and are too scared to tell anyone. Good move," end quote. The letter mentioned the media coverage, saying, quote, "I walked by the news trucks when they took over my neighborhood and mocked me," end quote. And Derek's attempt to catch them, saying, quote, "I watched you as you watched from the dark house in an attempt to find me. Telescopes and binoculars are wonderful inventions," end quote. The watcher also mentioned the Broaddus's attempt to tear down the house, saying, quote, "657 Boulevard survived your attempted assault and stood strong with its army of supporters barricading its gates. My soldiers of the Boulevard followed my orders to a T. They carried out their mission and saved the soul of 657 Boulevard with my orders. All hail the watcher," end quote. The author also alluded to the fact that they would seek revenge that could come in many forms, saying, quote, "Maybe a car accident, maybe a fire, maybe something as simple as a mild illness that never seems to go away but makes you feel sick day after day after day. Maybe the mysterious death of a pet, loved ones suddenly die, planes and cars and bicycles crash, bones break," end quote. Derek immediately took the letter to the police, hoping they would reopen the investigation. Again, they interviewed neighbors, with someone telling them about some teenager on the street who was odd, and another mentioning an older man that liked to walk around and play the flute. The Broaddus's racked their brains for anything out of the ordinary and sent a new list of potential suspects to the police, but nothing ever came of any of the names. By the spring of 2017, when the Broaddus's did the New York Magazine interview, they had not received any more letters. And although they had new renters in the house, they still felt uneasy. Derek said, quote, "It's all beautiful trees and beautiful houses, but all I feel is anxious. Sometimes I wake up in the middle of the night thinking, what would my life be like if this didn't happen? We lost Christmas a couple times, and you don't get that back. Christmas with a five-year-old," end quote. They also explained that while they do have new tenants, the rent still doesn't cover the mortgage. Derek explained that their children are sometimes teased at school about the whole ordeal, and they try to distance themselves from those who spoke out against them at the planning meeting. Derek said, quote, I see these people on the soccer field, at the train station, and my heart starts going like it did when I played hockey and was about to get in a fight, end quote. Derek said that they are hoping that no more letters would be sent and that they could sell the house in a few years. However, Christmas Eve of 2018, several people in Westfield who had criticized the Broaddus's in Facebook posts and online forums received their own letters in the mail. In these letters, the author accused these individuals of telling lies about the Broaddus's and having inaccurate information. They also told several stories of domestic terrorism and times that mental health issues had gone unnoticed. The letters were signed Friends of the Broaddus Family. These people had no idea who sent the letters, but when the New York Times journalist Reeves Wiedemann asked Derek Broaddus about them, he admitted that he had written them. He said that he was ashamed of writing them and that his wife didn't even know about them, and that they were the only anonymous letters he had ever written, and that he was not the author of the Watcher letters. He explained that it was extremely frustrating to sit back and watch his neighbors spew lies and hate about his family, and that he was fed up with all the negativity surrounding them. Journalist Reeves Wiedemann ended his article with the words, quote, The Watcher had been obsessed with 657 Boulevard, and Derek, in turn, had become obsessed with the Watcher and everything the letters had set in motion. It's like cancer, he told me. We think about it every day, end quote. In July of 2019, Derek and Maria finally sold their house at 657 Boulevard. It sold for $959,000, meaning that the Broadduses lost more than $400,000. So, what do you guys think about this story? Who do you think the Watcher is? There is lots of speculation in online forums such as Reddit, and there are many different theories out there. The first thing I saw mentioned the most was that the Broadduses should have moved in anyway and not have let the Watchers scare them off. I kind of have to agree with this, although I do not have children, so I think it would be completely different if I did. Yes, the letters were scary and threatening and unnerving, absolutely. But other than the construction sign being ripped off the wall that one time, nothing physical ever happened. However, many others say that they did the right thing and that they would not put their children in possible danger either just to live in their dream home. I also found several accounts of people who had been stalked and say that until it happens to you, you really don't understand the severity of the situation and how terrifying it can be and that it really does consume your whole life. Many point out that the older couple who lived behind the Broadduses and had their lawn chairs facing their house should have been investigated further and that they should have had to provide DNA samples. There is also a question of whether or not any of the home renovation employees, such as the contractors, construction workers, or painters, were ever questioned, which is something that I could not find in my research. These people were, you know, in the home for a large chunk of time and easily could have heard Maria say the kids' names and gotten to know the family and their routine. And although I did find some people online who believe that the Broadduses planned this entire thing for a variety of reasons, especially since Derek ended up writing some of his own letters, which was an awful idea, the consensus that I could find is that they did not write the letters themselves and that most people online feel really bad for this family and everything that they went through. Several people presented the theory that it was a group of neighbors who wrote the letters. This theory suggests that some older people in the neighborhood didn't want new money coming into the community or, you know, younger people ruining their pristine town. And together, they were able to keep eyes and ears on the Broadduses at all times, kind of like they would take shifts watching the house. Some also believe that it could have been an angry realtor who missed out on the huge commission from selling the house, or possibly a jilted ex, an angry friend, or even a jealous coworker. I personally don't really know who I think the Watcher is. When I first heard about this story, I was picturing this old-timey looking spirit that literally like floated above the house and had been there for years and was just watching it. And as cool and creepy as that sounds, I don't actually think that's what was happening. I think it was a person who wrote the letters. If I had to guess who I think the Watcher is, I would say probably a neighbor or a group of neighbors, Perhaps it was someone older who simply didn't want a young family moving into the neighborhood and making noise. Maybe it was someone who came from old money, you know, a long line of money, and didn't like seeing a family that had, you know, rose to success on their own and didn't come from wealthy families, came from a normal background, and maybe they didn't like that. It also most definitely could have been someone that they knew personally, maybe a coworker who Derek, you know, beat out of a promotion or something, and they were jealous that he had the money to buy such a fancy house. I also remember one time reading about a man who was having an affair, and when he cut it off with his mistress, she became obsessed and began sending threatening letters to the wife. Supposedly it happened for years, and they had to move several times before the police were able to trace it back to his jilted mistress. So who knows? Perhaps Derek or Maria had wronged somebody in some way, or someone just didn't like them and was trying to sabotage their, you know, happy, successful life. I really don't think, though, that it was the Broaddus's who did this to themselves. They really didn't want the story to go public, and were very upset when it did. And the New York Magazine article was the only interview that they've ever done about this. They also turned down multiple book and movie deals. Apparently, just last year, though, they did sell the rights for a movie to Netflix. But, I mean, this happened 5 years after the letters first started arriving, so I really can't see them pulling off a hoax for that long, just in the hopes of scoring a big movie deal when they had turned down previous deals in the past. That just doesn't really make sense to me. And if this was them writing it for money, obviously that backfired because they ended up in the hole almost, you know, $400,000 at the end of this whole thing. This story is definitely creepy and very unsettling, though, especially since they have never charged anyone for this. Like Derek said, he felt uncomfortable going out in public. I totally think I would feel the same way. I would constantly feel like there were eyes on me, not just from the watcher, but from my community members, too. I personally would probably want to move out of the area and just get away from all of it, but I also completely understand Maria's perspective on not wanting the watcher to win by driving them out of their own town and their own home. Although the investigation has stopped at this point, I hope that someday there is some closure to this for the Broaddus's and also for all of us, you know, nosy people that just want to know who the hell the watcher is. I want to know so badly. But what do you guys think? I would really love to hear your opinions. Do you think it's something supernatural, like a spirit of some sort that watches over this house? Maybe this house was built on some sacred ground of some sort. I think that idea is so cool, but I just don't know how invested I can get in that idea. Was it maybe a mentally ill neighbor? You know, Michael Langford was diagnosed with schizophrenia as a young man. Was it him, or was it someone similar who was battling some of their own demons and was taking it out on this family? Was it a jealous friend? There are so many possibilities. I would love to hear your thoughts. You can find me on Instagram and Facebook at Weird on the Rocks Podcast and Twitter at Weird_Rocks. Come and talk to me and let me know what you guys think. And until next time, cheers and stay weird.
That was a Titancast episode.